World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
There are no additional details on the Supreme Headquarters announcement that British General Dempsey's forces, with reinforcements of men and material by air, have made limited contact with the British Airborne Division in Holland. But the Second Army still is fighting to enlarge and strengthen that contact. The RAF has bombed the Rhineland in great strength in a continuation of the Allied air offensive. Romanian sources say the Russians have crossed into Hungary. Allied troops in Italy have driven the Germans from the entire northern end of the Gothic line and are sweeping into the Po Valley. And Tokyo says American planes have again raided the Philippines. And now news of the battles along the Western Front direct from overseas. Admiral takes you to London. Larry Lesser reporting.
There is still no strong link-up between the gallant band of British airborne troops holding out at Arnhem. But advance patrols from the 2nd British Army fought their way across the Dutch Rhine last night to give the nearly exhausted paratroopers a new ray of hope. The beleaguered British sky troops are still fighting in drizzling rain, holding off ceaseless German attacks, attacks aimed at recapturing the bridge over the Dutch Rhine, while the main British forces are struggling to widen their narrow corridor through Holland. As the 2nd British Army fights desperately to reach their besieged airborne comrades, they too are under heavy fire in their corridor sandwiched between powerful German forces. Latest reports from Holland indicate that the British Army has greatly strengthened the walls of this slender road north of Nijmegen. And last night, the Royal Air Force lent its weight to the seesawing battle. The British heavy night bombers attacked vital German communication points in the Ruhr in very great strength. The British airborne troops, marooned in the Arnhem area on the north bank of the Dutch Rhine for 7 days and seven nights now, have been compressed into very small space, despite the new reinforcements that reached them by air from England yesterday. You see, the German positions along the Rhine are in a position to machine gun and shell any British attempt to cross the river in force. So it looks as though the crossing of the Dutch Rhine at Arnhem will develop into one of the greatest battles of the war in the West. Bad weather has been helping the Germans to bring up guns and reinforcements, and poor visibility has hurt the effort of our bombers to knock back the German supplies. The American troops engaging the Germans all along the Siegfried Line have met increased enemy resistance over the weekend. East of encircled Aachen, American First Army troops faced reinforced shelling from new German guns as they crept eastward from newly captured Stolberg. In the Nancy area, the Germans managed to build up a considerable force of tanks to counterattack General Patton's Third Army troops. The German blow was gathering momentum when thunderbolts of the 9th Air Force roared up to the scene. Despite low clouds and bad visibility, the thunderbolt pilots swooped low to skip bomb the 100 German armored vehicles. The enemy tanks and armored cars countered with heavy fire at the German planes, or rather at the American planes. But finally, the attack was broken up, and the undamaged German tanks and cars withdrew to the protection of a forest. The American thunderbolts circled the forest, bombed it, and then raked it with cannon and machine gun fire until their ammunition was exhausted. The German Air Force itself appeared in some strength yesterday in an attempt to break up the Allied airborne relief operations in Holland. The German pilots took advantage of cloud cover when engaged by our protecting fighters. But thunderbolts broke up one large German formation near Nijmegen, knocking down 19 out of 30 German planes without loss to themselves. And this is Larry Lesser returning you now to Admiral.
More news in just a moment. First, here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Admiral Corporation, the leader in research on radar, television, communications equipment, and FM, will be able to give America many more Admiral firsts when victory is won.
I know that Admiral Radio is America's smart set. But what is Admiral doing about television?
Well, naturally, in a thing as big as television, there are many problems confronting both manufacturers and broadcasters to make television workable and within reach of America's millions of people. But Admiral Research in engineering and production has made the name Admiral the last word in smart, convenient, economical home radios. You can depend on Admiral for home television, too.
Will it be possible to get a television set built right into a radio phonograph combination?
Oh, I guess it's not giving away any trade secrets to tell you that. Eventually, you'll be able to get television in a wide range of models combined with radio or with a radio phonograph. And the new television and radio sets will reflect all the established Admiral skills and inventiveness. And they'll be built in the same great modern factories of Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
CBS correspondent Eric Severide, in a cable from southern France, says General de Gaulle has arrived on the French front after a triumphal tour through provincial cities of both eastern France. Severide says de Gaulle was met with an unfailing enthusiastic reception everywhere. He said this was proof that he has everyone's support in the interim of reorganizing the French government. And Severide's cable continues, 6,000 citizens of Besançon stood for 2 hours in the drizzle waiting for him yesterday. Tremendous cheers greeted his shouted declaration that we are not yet finished. Part of the Patria, our Alsace and our Lorraine, is still in enemy hands, but we will drive on the enemy's homeland. De Gaulle, who's learned much of the art of politics and now gestures freely, speaks confidently and colloquially, told the people that France's alliances and friendships with the outside world would help her only in the measure that the people of France, with their own hearts and bands, rebuilt the country and remake it materially, morally, and politically, so that France can again take its place in the world. Allied troops in Italy have overturned the entire eastern end of the German Gothic line. For details of that development, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome. Winston Burdett reporting.
The 8th Army today is slowly fanning out from the southeast corner of the Po Valley plain along the main highways leading to Ravenna and Bologna. The Germans have not yet begun a general withdrawal on this front. They are still being pushed back in stiff fighting, and the 8th is still building up its striking force for its next lunge northward. We hope to destroy a sizable part of the German army in the next stage of the battle. The 5th Army is now 15 miles from Bologna, well past the great watershed of the Apennines, past the battered and broken defenses of the Gothic line. Between our two breakthroughs, there are Germans, several divisions of them, still fighting in the mountains. And it is hard to see how they can all get out in time, or how they can fight a mobile campaign down in the valley, with their insufficient transport and with our undisputed power in the air. We are expecting rapid developments on the Balkan front also in coming weeks. Today, reporters here in Rome talked with the Greek Minister of Information. The entire Greek government is ready to go to Greece immediately upon its liberation by Allied troops, and the minister said that he thought this would be very soon. On the eve of that event, he made several important declarations. He said that the Greek government demands, unconditionally and without discussion, the restitution by Bulgaria of all Greek territories in Thrace and Macedonia, which Bulgarian troops are now occupying. He said that Greece would also demand certain revisions of her pre-war frontier with Bulgaria. He said finally that the Greek people have suffered economically more than any other in this war, through the destruction of some 1,300 towns and villages by the Germans, through undernourishment and the diseases that come of undernourishment. Any normal relief effort, the minister said, would be wholly insufficient to meet the situation in Greece today. This is Winston Burdett in Rome, returning you now to Admiral in New York.
Bucharest reports that Romanian and Russian troops have entered Hungary. For a summary of the situation on the Eastern Front, Admiral takes you now to CBS Moscow, Lee White of the Chicago Daily News Foreign Service, reporting.
The Red Army today is mopping up in Estonia, where the shattered Germans appear to be cut off from any hope of ever getting home. Most of the larger German ships that were taking part in the evacuation have been sunk. According to this morning's supplement to last night's Soviet communique, 11 transports loaded with German troops have been sunk in the past 48 hours, either by bombers or by torpedo planes. It appears to be the nearest thing to Dunkirk that the Germans have yet been made to suffer. Three loaded transports totaling 22,000 tons were sunk in the harbor of Tallinn. And off Pärnu, before its capture yesterday, Soviet bombers and torpedo planes attacked an evacuation convoy, sinking a 17,000-ton liner and three other smaller ships. Here in Moscow, the people are getting ready for what appears to be a long, hard winter. It's a common sight to see long lines of trucks, mainly trolley trucks, converted to run on electric current, distributing logs throughout the city to be chopped up for firewood. There's plenty of coal down in the Donbass region, but there isn't any way to get it up here. There aren't enough railroad cars and motor trucks to go around. But nobody seems to be complaining. Most people seem to be warming themselves in the thought that the war is almost over and that next year, certainly, there'll be enough fuel to go around. Speaking of the end of the war, one sign of it is the way buildings in Moscow are being repaired. The university, just beyond the American embassy, was somewhat battered by a number of bombs that fell nearby. But it was never repaired for lack of manpower, and because there was always the chance that Moscow might be bombed again. But now that danger has almost disappeared. The buildings of Moscow University have been completely redecorated and newly painted in cream and white. Even the blackout is a little less black than it used to be. It's black enough, of course, between midnight and dawn when there isn't any light at all. But until midnight, you now see perhaps 10 or 12 lights where before you only saw 2 or 3. I return you now to New York.
Timing plays an important role in this war, and a CBS reporter has arranged a broadcast in cooperation with a Marine Corps air arm to show how Marine flyers are trained in split-second timing. For this, Admiral takes you somewhere off the Carolina coast. Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
Here on the placid and peaceful waters off the Marine Corps Air Station at Cherry Point, North Carolina, we're going to attempt to give you an idea of one phase of fighting a modern war. It's called timing. Not split-second timing, but quarter-second timing, and it wouldn't really be so impressive except for the fact that it is routine, day in and day out. We're on a boat towing a target some 100 yards behind us. If my watch is correct, we should be dive-bombed in about 1 minute, although it is impossible to see a plane from this point. The invisibility today is unlimited. Just to the front of it, you listening at home, take a peek at your watch, and we'll see how close these Marine flyers come to bombing us at the time they were previously instructed to hit it. They're somewhere now at least 9,000 feet in the air, seeking whatever cloud cover they can find. With them is a group of fighters who will give us a strafing when the bombing is done. When the time comes for the dive bombing attack, the leader will do some lazy convulsive convolutions in the sky. He looks something like a seal rolling over to catch a fish. And then suddenly his plane will start to plummet toward that little target behind us. He'll fall pretty near 8,000 feet. That's about a mile and a half in 15 seconds. When he's about 1,000 feet above his target, a tiny little bomb, which grows until it looks like a cannon, will fall lazily away from the plane. And then suddenly his plane will start to plummet toward that little target behind us. He'll fall pretty near 8,000 feet. That's about a mile and a half in 15 seconds. When he's about 1,000 feet above his target, a tiny little bomb, which grows until it looks like a cannon, will fall lazily away from the plane, picking up speed and smash into or near the target. Behind will trail the rest of its troop, each at a 70-degree angle, each doing about 300 miles an hour, each carrying what is normally a terrifying load of death and destruction. They're coming in now and dropping their bombs into the troop. We're down to about 1,000 feet and we reach the bomb then. It's missed by about 100 yards. That's very close. Here's another. Second, that was close to approximately 25 yards. They're all coming in and dropping bombs and landing close to our target, but so far none have hit the target. On the target behind us, let's travel around the boat we're on. I hope they get something, but it must be remembered that dive bombing is a pretty quiet operation. some fighters which are to strafe us should be something else again. They're coming in out of some more angles. It's difficult to describe their descent because we don't know where they're coming from. Suddenly they're overhead. Well, there you have it. Fighters and dive bombers completing their training at the Cherry Point Marine Corps Air Station, demonstrating something of the time that is practiced in this very best drum of all wars. Miles of space, thousands of feet of altitude, astronomical airspeed, all drops, and a big combination of we radio people are pretty handy with stopwatches, but we're just bush leaguers compared to these young men flying for the Marine Corps. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
And now for news from the Pacific and an interview with a Navy commander from New Jersey, Admiral takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor, Tim Lemert reporting.
Fighting on Palalio continues to be static as Marines are slowly pushing the enemy toward the north end of the island. About three-fourths of this island in the Palaus is now in our hands. Seated with me today is Commander Bonnie M. Powell of the U.S. Navy, was one of the very first eyewitnesses back from this action in the Palaus. Commander Powell, whose home is Washington, D.C., is coordinating photography for the Pacific on the staff of the Commander-in-Chief. He is a former war correspondent for Fox Movietone News. Commander Powell, when did you reach the Palaus?
I was in the flagship of Admiral J.B. Oldendorf, commander of the forces that bombarded the island before D-Day. We caught sight of Peleliu at dawn, 3 days before the landing, when all our ships started to lay down their barrage. For those 3 days and nights, ships were given no rest as we poured thousands of tons of the island. From battleships, cruisers, destroyers, and planes, from those wonderful CVEs, the baby flat tops. Some of those old battleships are just the thing for pre-invasion shelling as they lay to off the island with their engines stopped and pump everything they have into the enemy defenses. They're really what you'd call floating artillery. All the time that we were shelling, the Avengers and Wildcats were shoving back and forth, strafing and dropping bombs with terrific effect, while at the same time searching for enemy strong points.
What were some of the many targets chosen?
It'd be hard to pick out any specific ones because, as far as I could see, anything that constituted a probable defense position was attacked. However, to answer that, I might say that the higher ground, that is literally honeycombed with thousands of caves, at the same time extremely well wooded, was singled out for the greatest shelling and bombardment. First, the trees, some of which were 10 feet in diameter, have to be cleared away so that the caves can be seen and strong defensive positions cleared out. The toughest of these were the hills commanding the northern part of the airstrip, from which the Japs fired their mortars and artillery.
Which of the beaches were you on?
Yellow 1, 2, and 3, which turned out to be the toughest spots when the Marines went in.
What was the story on D-Day?
Well, before each hour, everything opened up, pouring all they had into the beaches and islands. Then at each hour minus 5, all firing stopped and the Marines went in on the ducks and LVTAs. Heading the assault were the LCIs, gunboats that could come right up the reef and let go with guns and rockets. Everywhere you look was a mass of boats, and from all the firing, the smoke and dirt, almost secured the entire island. It was a sight that's impossible to describe, although some of the ducks stuck on the reef and others were hit. Most of them got in.
Did you see the invasion of Angar?
Yes. I flew over on a naval observation plane at each hour and saw the initial landing, which went very well. One of the strangest sights was the fact that although we flew over Angar at treetop level, we couldn't see a Jap gun or a sign of habitation. The Japs are masters at concealment.
What about future progress on Palalio?
Progress may be slow, as we will deal with the Japs as it suits us, while waiting for more supplies to be brought in, to knock out the fortified positions in Limestone Hills.
Thank you, Commander Bonnie M. Powell. This is Tim Lemert in Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral in New York.
For another interview with two fighting men who had experience with our airborne units in Europe, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Joe McCaffrey reporting.
Any doubt as to the great value of airborne operations in modern warfare was wiped away by the action of the past week. Airborne operations in Holland have been further highlighted by indications from Air Force officers that a similar invasion of Berlin could possibly be undertaken. Today, as our guests, we have two experienced airborne men, Captain Charles Barnett, who took part in the invasions of Sicily, Italy, and France, and First Sergeant Hubert Odom, who landed behind enemy lines on D-Day. Captain Barnett wears the Silver Star, the European Theater Ribbon, and the Purple Heart with the Oak Leaf Cluster, having been wounded in Italy and in France. Sergeant Odom holds the DSC, the Presidential Citation, and ribbons of the European and American theaters. Captain, I understand that your unit had a pretty rough time on D-Day. Suppose you tell us a little of the action.
We had a pretty hot time of it. Our objective was the town of St. Mary, Greece. The troops from the beachhead were pushing the enemy back toward us, and the enemy was active all around us. We were in a neat pocket. The town had been used as German headquarters, and they were determined to retake it. Our battalion held the town for 2 days before contact was made with our forces from the beach.
Were you wounded there?
No, I wasn't wounded until several weeks later. But I think that we ought to put in a word here about the medical men who jumped with us. The medics, of course, are unarmed, but they are right in the thick of it. They set up first aid stations and give the wounded excellent care.
Yes, when we landed, we were armed. But even then, we had to scurry to cover. The medics who took cover began setting up first aid stations and crawling out to bring wounded men back so they could give aid.
Your operations were at night, weren't they?
That's right. But this landing last week in Holland was the first real large-scale daylight landing. Most operations have been carried out under the protective cover of darkness. But the success of the one in Holland in daylight proves the real value of this method of warfare.
Sergeant, you're wearing the Distinguished Service Cross. Would you tell us how you earned it?
Well, we had to take the town of Carrington. But for 2 days and one night, a machine gun team held us down. There was a whole outfit held down by one well-placed machine gun crew. On the second night, my company spearheaded an assault on the gun position and knocked it out. With that out of the way, we went on to win the town.
Captain, as an old hand at these operations, what do you think of an airborne operation against Berlin?
I know I'd like to be in on it. Of course, such an operation would have to be on a massive scale, and you can't attempt anything like that unless your land troops are near enough to reach a junction with your outfit within a reasonable amount of time.
I take it that both of you are well sold on paratroop and airborne outfits.
That's right. There's no more risk with airborne than any other arm of service. And the morale of our units are better than the best.
And the Army is looking for more volunteers. So any man that wants to get in and can pass the physical examination will be accepted.
Thank you very much, Captain Barnett and First Sergeant Odom. I return you to Admiral in New York.
In Hartford, Connecticut, Rear Admiral Thomas Gatch, the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, warned today that the war in the Pacific will be long and tough, and he reminded that there is no easy outflanking maneuver available to bring a quick finish. Now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
There will be purified moist coal in every inch of the extra-large regular food storage compartment of the Admiral two-temperature refrigerator. This purified moist coal will end the need for covered dishes to keep food from wilting or drying out, will keep lettuce crisp, keep sliced meat, cheese, and leftovers moist for many days longer. There'll be more room for food, too, since the bulky, frost-collecting coils that dry out food will be gone. So there'll be no regular, messy job of defrosting. The second compartment, the big built-in home freezer, will make possible the home freezing of your own foods, meat, vegetables, fruits, desserts, or will keep commercially frozen foods for months. 6 years of pre-war consumer approval makes it possible for Admiral to promise you everything that's newest and best in electric refrigeration. As Admiral Radio, America's smart set, has become a favorite in so many homes, so will the Admiral two-temperature refrigerator add to the convenience, comfort, and health of thousands of American families. In some localities, many hospital wards and even whole hospitals have been forced to close because of a doctor-nurse shortage. Because medical facilities everywhere are overtaxed, women are urged to enroll in an American Red Cross home nursing class. Your help can be invaluable to the health of your community. To enroll in a home nursing course now, consult your local Red Cross chapter immediately. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you world news today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is Warren Sweeney speaking for the Admiral Corporation. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.